Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the second season of Among the Ancients, a close reading series from the London Review of Books with me, Thomas Jones, and Emily Wilson. Today, we're talking about Greek lyric poets and Pindar and Bacchylides in particular. The librarians of Alexandria in the 3rd century BC established a canon of 9 lyric poets. So, Emily, who were they and when and where did they live? I mean, obviously 9's quite a lot, but just to give a sense of...
9's quite a lot, but it was supposed to be the selected, the best 9, as opposed to all the 9 that the Alexandrian scholars were aware of or had access to. So there's something also frustrating about the fact that they were, thanks to their listing and canonizing and librarianing, we lost even more than we otherwise might have done. So they were from all over the place in the Greek-speaking world and also spanning 2 centuries. So the oldest one we know about, we only have fragments of, is Alcmaeon of Sparta, then Sappho, Alcaeus, Anacreon, Stesichorus, Ibicus, Simonides, and then Bacchylides and Pindar are the most recent ones that we have from the mid-5th century, or the early to mid-5th century.
So yeah, we won't be giving people a test on the names at the end. And Sappho obviously is the most famous and the most read nowadays. Mm-hmm. I say I would guess, but I would bet a lot of money on Sappho being read much more widely than any of the others.
I bet you.
And we talked about her last year and about Anne Carson's translations. But why the number 9? Is it because there were 9 muses?
Absolutely, yeah. So just a completely random, in certain ways, number, which, I mean, many people sort of want to have around dozens or a top 10 lists. I mean, it's the same sort of compiling magic of numbers, but the 9 muses are obviously the reason. And there were other lists. So there was also a list of the 9 best female poets. Again, like, we don't have most of those beyond Sappho. You know, those people in Alexandria love to make their lists.
And obviously, as you've said, there were many other composers of Greek lyric verse, some of whose work have survived and presumably many more who haven't. And in Andrew Miller's anthology of Greek lyric in English, which subscribers to Close Readings Plus will have received a copy of, and we'll be listening to extracts from his translations in the course of this episode. But presumably there are many more than 19 who have survived. I mean, there are the 9 canonical ones. There are these other 10 who Andrew Miller's included. There are presumably a few more who we have fragments of, and then unknown numbers.
We have fragments and quotations of quite a lot of other... I mean, I think we should maybe talk about the category of lyric, because the reason that those 9 are categorized as lyric and people that the Alexandrians were also perfectly well aware of, like Solon, for instance, doesn't count as lyric because he wrote an elegiac meter. So for the ancients, there were these sharp distinctions between the lyric meters, which have this sort of complexity metrically and musically, and were performed with dancing and sometimes to the lyre, but then also sometimes to the lyre plus the aulos, the pipe music. But then there were these other non-dactylic meters, which weren't categorized as lyric, many of which also occur in the Miller volume. So the question of what is lyric, and also could it be lyric if it included mostly aulos music as opposed to lyre music? If you sort of include dithyramb, which did have aulos rather than lyre as lyric, then it's, you know, what is lyric? It's part of the question too. Does it have to have a lyre to be lyric?
Right. Yeah. I mean, presumably there are good reasons for dividing things up in these different ways, but it's possible to get slightly lost in the categories. There's a very loose modern sense of lyric, which is what we might think of as romantic or post-romantic lyric poetry, that it's not epic, it's not narrative, it's a, although of course some of these so-called lyric ones do have stories in them, so it doesn't really fit with that. I mean, is there any sense in which it's helpful to think of a lyric age? I mean, there is this idea, as it were, you have Homer and Hesiod first, and then you have the lyric age, and then sort of classical Athens with tragedy and so on. I mean, is there a sense in which it's useful as a chronological category?
I mean, it's useful in that it comforts us with the idea that we haven't lost anything, and that what we have in terms of our very Athena-centric evidence corresponds to everything that actually mattered in terms of literature and culture in antiquity. There were certainly were lyric poets who were composing new lyric songs or new poetic songs into the late 5th and 4th century. But unfortunately, we don't have most of them. So part of the narrative is that lyric and these other forms of song culture were absorbed into Athenian drama. So tragedy includes lyric. It includes the choral sections, which have a lot of affinity with what people like Pindo and Bicalides were doing, metrically, sonically, musically. But then another piece of the story is that a lot of what was happening in standalone lyric and dithyramb in the late 5th century is lost beyond quotations. And we have lots of mockery of people like Timotheus in old comedy. So people like Aristophanes were saying, hey, they're trying these fancy things. They're adding extra strings to the lyre. It's so newfangled and crazy and elaborate. And we actually do have some Timotheus. There's a papyrus fragment of this very interesting poem about the Persians, which was composed in the later part of the 5th century and doesn't have anything to do with Pindar. It's a very different style of poetics. And we have epigraphic evidence for choral music and dance and poetry being performed all over the place in the 4th century. So I think there's something a little bit historically inaccurate about saying lyric died with Pindar, because it didn't actually. People were still composing songs and composing new songs. And then people were also reperforming Pindar and Bicalides and these other greats. So there's sort of both a continuity in terms of replay value for these poems that are very much composed for a single occasion, but then were reread and reperformed all over the place. And then also there were, you know, new songs.
And I think that calling them songs is quite helpful, really, because it's very easy to get into the idea that, I mean, the way that they've come down to us as written texts, as black and white, I mean, in the same way that we imagine Greek statues of white marble, when in fact they were painted, that the quite austere written texts, and of course they weren't, they were performed, they were sung, they were danced to, they were, I mean, lyric more in the sense perhaps of song lyrics than in the sense of lyric verse.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, and I think actually the question you were asking before about the different subgenres of song culture, I think it's useful to think like a better analogy is all the different subcultures of country music versus rap versus pop versus, I mean, there were all these different things which actually can overlap with each other in certain ways, but then also can have somewhat different performance contexts. And so I think a lot of the most interesting work that's being done in this generation of scholarship on Greek lyric and song poetry is about performance and what can we possibly dig up about choreography and music and all these elements, which very frustratingly we don't have because what we have is the text.
Okay, so it's probably about to say, in that analogy, who is Pindar? Is he sort of a prog rocker or a Bob Dylan sort of figure? But that's probably going too far. One of the things that he isn't, that there was also, well, what might be called diss poetry, where...
Exactly, yes.
or blame poetry. Sort of Pindar wasn't that. But there's Hipponax, for example, who's very much not one of the canonical nine, but he is in Miller's anthology. And one of his fragments quoted by Miller is, "Hold my jacket, people. I'm going to punch Boupalos in the eye. I'm ambidextrous and my punches never miss," which... I don't know, not quite Eminem, but it's not.
Yes. Yes. So Hipponax wrote in this meter called iambic meter, which was associated with the sort of proto-satirical. The term satire is, of course, much later, but as you say, it's a diss form of poetry, and it's often taken to be a sort of precursor to comedy in that it focuses on dissing individuals and going on about food and being cold and just sort of ordinary mishaps in life, and also being very aggressive and, you know, getting a laugh out of the audience by being rude to people, which, I mean, it's kind of a fun kind of poetry. And it's, of course, set up very much in contrast to the multiple different forms of praise poetry that people like Pindar performed. And also, in a way, Hipponax's kind of diss poetry can be seen as potentially more democratic, or at least not aristocratic. It's not about kissing ass to the tyrants or the richest guy on the island in the way that Pindar's poetry very often is.
And presumably there were poets who wrote all different kinds. They wrote iambics and they wrote victory odes. And I mean, they didn't restrict themselves to one form.
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting thing. I mean, as in the much later discussion of Socrates at the end of the symposium saying, could the same person write tragedy and comedy? Is that even possible? Never happens. It seems to be a similar sort of thing that poets sort of divided into, are you going to be a diss poet? In which case you might well write sympotic poetry, like drinking party poetry, as well as obscene poetry and satirical poetry, but you wouldn't necessarily be the same person as the one who's writing the hymns and the victory odes. So the kind of genres that Pindar and Bicalides write are in that second category of hymns, victory odes, praising rich people in various different ways. By praising people who can afford to hire them to do it, you know. But of course, you don't hire somebody to write a poem saying, punch me in the nose. It's a different pay model.
And one of the reasons why we're talking more about Pindar today, there is more Pindar than any other lyric poet, though what survives is, as ever, only a fraction of what he actually composed. But as Barbara Graziosi put it in the Albion in 2008, Pindar's victory odes have never been out of circulation. And that in itself is presumably an indication of the esteem that they've always been held in.
Pindar has always been thought to be extremely good or sublime, according to Pseudo Longinus, the author of the Treatise on the Sublime. He has this account of, you know, everyone always recognizes greatness in the sublime, and nobody would ever prefer Ion of Chios over Sophocles, and nobody would ever prefer Bacchylides over Pindar. Pindar is the best out of the lyric possibilities. Which, in fact, you know, one could say it's maybe debatable, because people did actually invite Bacchylides and maybe he came cheaper, but maybe people actually liked it too, because there are things to like about Bacchylides. But Pindar, as you say, has always been in circulation, even though what we have of Pindar surviving now is 4 books out of what we're told was an original 17. So we only have the victory odes. We don't have all the other genres that he wrote in beyond in fragmentary form from papyri.
Thanks for listening to this extract from Among the Ancients 2, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. To listen to the full episode and all our other Close Reading series, including Series 1 of Among the Ancients, sign up to our Close Reading subscription at lrb.me/closereadings or click on the link in the description.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.